Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today is my dear friend and partner in crime, Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind the indispensable Danwei.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Hi, Kaiser. I'm good.
And with us on this lovely evening for the whole segment is someone we don't hear from often enough, Anant Krishnan, the China correspondent for The Hindu. Welcome back, Anant.
Thank you, Kaiser. Happy to be here.
We thought we'd make up for the rareness of your appearance by giving you lots of airtime today.
Sounds good.
Great. So, podcast listeners, if you follow Anant's work, you'll know that he's probably the best-regarded journalist writing for any Indian publication here in China. And he's on Twitter at Anant, fill in the blank here. What's your Twitter
handle? It's just Anant Krishnan.
Okay, A-N-A-N-T-H.
K-R-I-S-H-N-A-N.
K-R-I-S-H-N-A-N. Right. Great. So follow him there at Twitter. And we are very fortunate that all of the topics we'll be discussing today are things that Anant has written on recently. First, we're going to look at the subway crash that took place on the new Shanghai Metro Line 10 on Tuesday the 27th, injuring some, what was it, Jeremy?
284 is what the Shanghai Daily said.
Yeah, 284 people. And I guess more seriously, delivering another black eye to the reputation of China's rail transport infrastructure, which, of course, got the worst of it on, what was it, July 23rd with the big crash in Wenzhou. We're then going to talk about the India-China Strategic Economic Dialogue. Listeners to Seneca may recall that we did a Sino-Indian relations podcast in December of last year where Anant joined us. So 10 months on, I think it's a good opportunity for us to revisit the topic and see what has changed on that front. And finally, we're going to talk about the state of Islam in China. This is something that Anant has written on extensively in a series that he's done for The Hindu. With reporting, Anant, you were in Xinjiang, you were in Ningxia.
Xinjiang and Ningxia.
Okay, yeah, good. And the Ningxia Hui Autonomous Region. Let's just jump right in and talk about first the subway crash that happened last Tuesday afternoon. First, let's get the basic facts straight. Anant, Jeremy, you've both been following this. I've had a pretty hellish week, so I haven't followed it as closely as I would have liked to. But Jeremy, you had a conversation with a Caixin reporter who had written extensively on recent problems with signaling equipment in particular. What did you learn from that conversation?
Well, that there seems to be a lot of problems with signaling equipment. She'd been researching the high-speed network rather than the metro system. But it's not clear whether some of this equipment was apparently to blame for the Wenzhou crash, if it came from the same source as this subway accident.
Right. We'll get into that in some depth. But let's what actually happened on that afternoon?
So it was September the 27th.
That's right. It was Tuesday.
There was a crash. It was, similar in a way to the Wenzhou high-speed crash because it was a rear-end collision. So one train rear-ended another one. Nobody was killed.
It was Chengdu, though, right?
Right. let's explain that. So nobody died. And the CCTV news report that night had, as the big caption at the bottom of the screen when they were talking about the story, that, you know, Shanghai had a Chengdu Zhuiwei accident. So a light rear-end collision, which immediately became an internet meme. So people have been making jokes about having, you know, a light case of cancer or a light case of your wife having an affair or a light case of
pregnancy.
The internet, again, similar to the aftermath of the Wenzhou incident, has been a source of much humor, black humor, and criticism of the infrastructure projects in China. The criticism hasn't been quite as vocal or as vicious, probably because nobody died.
Right.
And the subsequent censorship of the discussion about it has also been a little bit lighter than after Wenzhou.
And censorship has been commensurate with that lightness. It's been Chengdu censorship.
Chengdu guancha. Chengdu shensha. It seems that it did catch the imagination of a lot of people on the internet, which is understandable. Shanghai, China's, you know, richest city, full of people who may not care about anything else but do care about their own safety when commuting.
Anath, what are some of the other pertinent details we need to know about what happened?
It seems that there's some confusion over what actually went wrong. I'm not sure Jeremy might know. I think they first said it was a power failure and then a manual error or maybe a combination of both.
So that sounds familiar. It wasn't struck by lightning, though?
No, no lightning.
No, although people made jokes to that effect. Right. At least on the internet, I mean, because there's been a sort of shutdown of the debate in the media, we don't really know from an official source what the authoritative explanation is at this point. But on the internet, a lot of people were blaming the Casco Signal Limited company.
Casco is a joint venture, actually, between a Chinese company and a French firm called Alstom.
Alstom.
A-L-S-T-O-M. Yeah, it's at least in America, it's always a good thing to do, just sort of to
blame the French.
Blame the French. No,
it's always in
cheese
China
eating
too.
Surrender yeah. monkeys.
China's also a good place to blame.
We
the French.
Had someone from the company today actually.
Oh, you did.
Categorically put up a statement, I think, to Bloomberg saying that the accident had absolutely nothing to do with our equipment. So I'm not sure how that's going to play out when they officially come out with what went wrong. So,
but they might not. You know, they still haven't officially come out with what went wrong. With the Wenzhou train accident, and the deadline that had been given for a full report to have been made was September the 15th.
That's come and gone. Right.
That's come and gone.
Hmm. This is not the first accident to beset Shanghai in recent months and years. There's been a whole series of them, and they all seem designed to piss off the middle-class denizens of China's most populous and most prosperous city. We had a building just sort of topple over in the suburbs. You had this gigantic fire in which many, many, many people died. And, of course, now this subway crash. Where's all this going? I mean, what's happening? Shanghainese, are they in the streets about this at this point like they were with the fire? Anyone seeing popular reaction in Shanghai? You didn't get down there and do any reporting.
No, unfortunately, I wanted to before the fire. But I did go there a few weeks after the fire. But I think that it was interesting that as far as I could tell, both in terms of what happened after the fire and this, the party officials in Shanghai have really responded in a quick way, mm-hmm. in to some extent.
They did, but it's again this weird thing of the government can't seem to get public relations in this country. They posted an apology, in fact, to Weibo,
right.
And then it was deleted. And then there was another apology posted to the internet that was also deleted. So it's
really
sort of,
no, that's interesting. So the case of the vanishing apology.
What is
going on here?
Well, somebody apologized, and somebody else higher up said, fuck up because never apologize.
Right.
It can only get you into trouble.
Now,
my interpretation, on no insider knowledge.
You sort of hinted at that they're at least kind of learning maybe from the series of mishaps.
I was hoping so when we had they put the message up on Weibo and I thought, well, at least this is a positive step. And then you had, I think, Yu Zhengsheng within 2 hours go down to the hospital, the main hospital where people were being treated. That's the Shanghai party chief. So I thought that was a pretty good reaction in the sense that, looking at how things work in India, when we have like a big train accident with casualties, it takes a week for a minister to actually visit the spot. India is not a good standard of reference for railway safety. But I noticed the contrast that they seem to respond quickly. And I think we also had an official who bowed down before the cameras.
There was a bow.
Right,
yeah.
There was some
and that seemed to have got some good response.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
But contrition probably isn't enough. There is going to be an investigation now into this whole signaling business. So that was interesting that you said that today there was a statement, an official statement to Bloomberg. Now
the French company saying that it was nothing got to do with our equipment.
That actually came from Alstom or from the JV?
It came from Alstom.
Okay, interesting. We can't blame the French, or maybe we still can. I'm not sure we have too much more to add on this particular topic. It's just a couple of days old. We'll have to sort of see how things develop, and of course we'll keep our loyal listeners posted on what's happening with this. Why don't we just move on quickly then to the India-China Strategic Economic Dialogue, which kicked off earlier this week. This next topic on this relationship between China's two fast-rising billion-plus countries. Anand, tell us about, by way of background, there's a new Indian foreign minister, or foreign secretary, Ranjan Mathai?
Yep.
All right. I know he didn't represent India in this current round of the dialogue, but presumably, you know, his new administration or his ministry is sort of the driving force behind it. Is there a new attitude that's discernible?
I think so, because it's interesting to note that this strategic economic dialogue that the two countries now have, India only has a comparable sort of dialogue mechanism with the United States, which kind of shows how seriously India is taking the relationship with China. And it's sort of been played up by both countries because part of the reason is, given that we have such political distrust between both countries, the trade relationship is sort of seen as the one bright spot in the relationship. So they've been sort of going all guns out in terms of trying to promote trading ties and to sort of present the relationship in a good light. And
has the total trade volume increased appreciably this last year?
It has. It's grown pretty quickly. It was about a couple of $1 billion in 2000, and I think in 2010 it was $60 billion.
Okay.
And China is now India's single biggest trading partner.
It's a $60 billion trade, but I mean, it divides pretty unevenly.
The numbers look good on the surface, but if you look through them, it's kind of very unevenly divided. It's $40 billion sort of Chinese exports to India. And India's exports are just raw material like iron ore and chemicals. And so we aren't selling any finished products to China. So I think part of the reason why they set up this dialogue was to find a way to address these trade issues, but to also sort of look beyond trade and look at how they can work together on sort of common issues they're facing. Like even railways is one of the three areas they're focusing on.
Interestingly.
So look at how India can learn from the high-speed rail. And seriously. And so they're trying to push the relationship to another level, which is what sort of drove this dialogue.
I mean, what realistically can they think of in terms of policies that China might pursue to do something about this massive trade imbalance? I mean, I think there are limited things that China can actually do to right this balance. I mean, it's not a currency issue. It's not.
No, it's not. I think they're sort of focused on two areas, which is like Indian IT and Indian pharmaceuticals. And India sort of is making the claim that, well, we sell IT to the West, to Europe and America, but China is the only country where we don't sell any IT. So they're trying to sort of lobby Chinese companies to sort of take Indian IT more seriously.
Right.
I don't know how far that's going to go, because I think Western IT companies have been here, Kaiser, you'd know, maybe for 30, 40 years.
That's right.
So Indian companies have been here for 10 years. So things don't happen overnight.
They are here, though. I mean, Infosys has an office here. Satyam has an office
and
here.
And Tata as well.
Tata, I think,
is the one company that's actually had success in getting a contract from the Bank of China. I think the rest of them are all servicing Western companies in China.
That's right. So I actually wrote sort of comparing Indian and Chinese software outsourcing. You know, there's this general idea abroad that the total size of the Indian software sector is actually bigger than China's. That's actually not true. Of course, you know, China has a gigantic domestic software market, but there's also a lot of onshore offsourcing. There are a lot of competitors to Indian companies that do outsourcing to big Chinese firms, to the big banks, to China Mobile and China Telecom and other major clients, as well as competing for the Microsofts and the Ciscos and things like that. A lot of that, of course, is aimed at a different market. They're aimed at Korea and Japan, especially out of Dalian,
right,
where a lot of these guys are based. So I'm not sure there's any kind of apples-to-apples comparison to be made. But it's encouraging, though, that Tata is actually...
I think they got like $150 million contract, I think, with the Bank of China.
Okay.
But I think that what they're trying to do is they're trying to put as much pressure as they can on China, saying, well, if this is the one bright spot in the relationship, and if you want to have good ties, well, do something about it, and because we can't sell this relationship back home. Because now the deficit is sort of something that the media keeps harping on.
What about pharmaceuticals? So, what's the obstacle here? I mean, India is a massive producer of especially generics.
Right. So I think there's sort of two sides to this, because the Indian companies say, well, the Chinese registration procedures are too complicated, and they seem to have it in for us, and they don't reach out to us. But then when I speak to Chinese officials about this, they say, well, like American companies are here with big offices, a big team of lawyers, and they work with
the SFDA
our laws. Yeah, and they deal with it. But they said, well, the Indian companies kind of expect business to come to them and don't go out in search of it.
I think
both sides have like there's some justification in the explanations. But I think the larger sort of issue to this dialogue is what they're trying to, this is the first round. So what they're trying to do is like it's going to be a hard sell for them back home, because when we met the Indian official who was heading it, who's the head of our planning commission, mm-hmm. and so the dialogue takes place between the Indian Planning Commission and the Chinese NDRC.
NDRC, right.
So like he was sort of saying, well, it's more about exchanging ideas and, you know, knowledge transfer, learning from how China built its railway network, which is now, you know, left India in the dust. So, but it's a hard sell back home, because when people keep looking at the numbers and the trade relationship, when you talk about a knowledge transfer, I mean, it just doesn't go far. So.
Right. Last time we were talking about this, one of the issues that we brought up was that within the Chinese intelligentsia very broadly, and within the foreign policy communities, there's sort of an imbalance where Indians tend to be very focused on everything that's happening in China, whereas Chinese, for the most part, are indifferent or even abjectly ignorant about what's
Absolutely,
happening in
yeah.
India. Do you see this at an official level? Or do you see this changing at an official level?
I think it sort of by and large persists
yeah.
in the Chinese side. I think it's interesting because India now has this obsession. It has become an obsession with China, in terms of there's this terrible anxiety at where this relationship is going. And China's relationship with Pakistan is, of course, a huge sort of issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in China, you just don't see comparable, for instance, media coverage. And in China, when you do get media coverage, usually it's like a really nasty sort of editorial in the Global Times saying that, well, we're far ahead of you, so you should, you know, mind your behavior. So
stop, I mean, stop all that democracy you have down there. That's very bad for your development, clearly.
Absolutely. So those are kind of two themes that you sort of see saying, well, you should know where your place is, and, well, your system isn't working. But I don't know. I do see that change. The only sort of area where I see it changing is I think China in the last 12 months has been really bad for its relationship with all of its neighbors, whether it's over the South China Sea or India. So I think it's hard to tell how serious they are about it, but I think they do worry that having bad relations with India as well is just something they can't handle at this point of time. I think they see their plate full. So they have been, in the last 12 months, you do see signs coming from them, like following Wen Jiabao's visit to India in December, saying that, well, I think there's a little bit of apprehension in reaching out to Pakistan. They've been trying to rebalance ties between two, which I haven't seen in the last 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they've quite figured it out themselves, but I do see an effort in trying to at least paint this relationship in a good light, which I didn't see 2 years ago.
And Anand, how is India's relationship with Southeast Asia, with Burma, Vietnam, Thailand?
India and Vietnam is very interesting because up until maybe 12 months ago, there was very little contact between the two. But right about the time when we had these sort of troubles with China over these so-called border incursions, and Vietnam had troubles with China over fishing boats, right. In the South China Sea. So in the last 6 to 8 months, we had Indian, I think maybe the army chief visit Vietnam. I could be wrong. We did have our foreign minister who was in Vietnam maybe 2 weeks ago. So we're seeing this momentum that we have never seen before. And
China's got to love this.
Yeah. And we had this sort of one incident where we had this Indian naval ship that had gone to like a port of call exchange visit with Vietnam. And on the way back to India, they were radioed. And it was like an anonymous caller who said he was from the Chinese Navy. And he said, you're in China's waters and get out. So and this became like a big issue. But then India and China strangely played it down. The Indian government said, well, we don't know if it's the Chinese Navy. It could be like a prank call. So they...
merchant channels.
But that kind of stretches the imagination, though. I mean, if you're in the middle of the South China Sea and you get a call saying, leave the waters. So you're right. You do see, I think India is reaching out more to Southeast Asia as well, Vietnam. And Burma is a very sensitive sort of issue back home because a lot of people in India aren't happy with how we're dealing with the regime and investing there. And then you had, I think, the Burmese leader went, I think last year he visited Mahatma Gandhi's tomb in Delhi. So when you had a picture of him at Gandhi's tomb, it just really upset a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous irony there that could not be lost on the human rights community.
But I think the government feels that you can't ignore them because by doing so, you're just driving them you're driving China up to our borders. And India feels they need their support because we have this insurgency in the Northeast. And a lot of their arms and a lot of funding comes in through Myanmar. So the Indian government feels that it has to deal with
this. Is it the Maoists or...
There are Maoists and a couple of others. There's a couple of other groups along the border.
What are they called? The Natalites or the...
Not the Naxalites. It's different sort of insurgent groups, different...
This is in
the
Assam,
Northeast.
Right? This is
in, yeah, in right. Assam and Nagaland and different...
Okay, Nagaland, right. There are going to be boundary talks. There's going to be a whole new round of summitry in Delhi next month. Is that correct?
They haven't actually fixed up the dates. It's probably either November or December is what I hear.
And that's between Shiv Shankar Menon
and Dai Bing Guo.
And Dai Bing Guo, okay.
And that sort of just goes on and on. I think this is the 15th round.
Right.
And they haven't agreed. It's like they've had 15 rounds of talks, and right now they're in stage 2 of 3. I think the first stage was sort of what they call political parameters, which is kind of really vague, which is the easy sort of stage. But now, like, they're working on actually demarcating the boundary and coming at a framework. And
well, these things take time. You have to decide the shape of the table, and then
yeah. And I asked the Chinese, like, it's around 15. Do you think this is going to 45 or 15? They're like, well, maybe. So I don't think anyone expects this to go anywhere. It's just you just talk just for the sake of talking. So
well, talking is better than not talking.
True.
Great. Let's let me encourage everybody who wants to hear more about the Chinese and Indian relationship to go to the, I think it was December 17th or thereabout, sometime in mid-December when we had Anathan last time, and listen to that podcast, because I think there are a lot of issues that we talked about then. We were talking then about Aksai Chin and about South Tibet
and Kashmir as well.
So we'll anyone who wants to get a little more in depth on that, please go revisit that podcast. Let's move on to our third and major topic for the evening, which is Islam in China. Anand, as we said earlier, had recently been doing quite a bit of reporting out of the Ningxia Hui Autonomous Region and out of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. What inspired you first to look at this particular issue at this particular time? Had this anything to do with the unrest that we've experienced this summer in Xinjiang? Or
yes, that's the reason I went to Xinjiang was because of the recent events, and I really enjoyed traveling there. I try to make it a point to go there at least twice a year, and I think for one, there's a lot of interest in India because India has such a big Muslim community.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always interest in what's happening. China has 20 million Muslims, which surprises people in India, and they don't think China has such a big Muslim community. So there is always interest. I've always had an interest to see how this community is doing. And I think it's really fascinating because you have these 20 million Muslims who you meet, whether they're Hui Muslims or Uyghurs. It's very interesting because there's this tension that's been going on, I think, for the last few decades, where you see this community that's fighting very hard to keep, religious knowledge going and keep its traditions going. And it's an environment that's very, in some ways, hostile to Islam. So it's very fascinating to see how this sort of tension is playing out.
Let's just, for our listeners who don't have a lot of deep knowledge about the Muslim populations of China, let's give them a little bit of background on who the major Muslim groups are in China. You mentioned, of course, the Uyghurs, who are a ethnically Turkic group of people living in Jungaria, in the Tarim Basin, in the oasis cities along the north and south of the Taklamakan Desert. They are not ethnically, I'm on dangerous ground here. They
don't look Chinese.
They don't look Chinese. Well
put. Well put. No, and
well
then,
put. Always the one for delicacy. Yeah.
And the Hui Muslims are the biggest group. They are about half of the 20 million Muslims in China are Hui.
Right.
And of course, we should remember there's no relation between the Huis and the Uyghurs ethnically.
In fact, there are often tensions, actually. There were a lot of Hui who were killed in the July 2009.
Absolutely. And historically as well, I think even in the 18th century, 19th century, we had clashes. We had like a rebellion where you had Huis.
I remember Uyghur telling me that the thing with Huis is that when they're Chinese around, they take off their Muslim skull cap, and when they're Uyghurs around, they put it on.
I've heard,
Let's talk about who they come from historically. If memory serves, they came in to China actually as early as the tail end of the massive period of Muslim expansion in 7th century. From Tang all the way, and the big wave, I suppose, came in during the Yuan dynasty when the court of Kublai Khan used a lot of Muslims from Persia, from Central Asia, from even the Arab Middle East as administrators in the UN court, and a lot of them settled. They were, in some sense, assimilated. I mean, to the point where you know, you can't. I mean, some people say you can tell by the shape of the nose, or but they looked like Jeremy so delicately, but they look very, you know.
No, and I think that's in essence the difference between the two regions, because here you've had, especially in the last, you've had 500 years of assimilation.
And they speak Chinese.
They speak Chinese. They don't speak Arabic anymore. Right. Most of them don't. So when you have, and so they've married with the Chinese and they've assimilated over 500 years, and you don't have a language barrier. But in Xinjiang, it's just been in the last 6 decades. I mean, you haven't had relations between the two. You've had very little relations between the two ethnic groups, between Han and Uyghur. And it's all just been in the last few decades. So, which is why you see the level of tension that you see in Xinjiang, which you just don't see in Ningxia.
They're ethnically quite separate. Right.
They're also Hui, very widely dispersed.
Yeah, that's
in China.
What I was going to say.
I mean, Tibet has a lot of Hui.
Right. Let's talk
Beijing
about
has a lot of Hui.
The geographic distribution
of them.
The Northeast,
they're really all Mongolia. Over the country.
But the major pockets, are in the Ningxia.
Ningxia, I think about a third. Maybe not even. I think about 2 million out of 10. So that's a fifth. In Ningxia, so they're quite well dispersed.
A lot in neighboring Gansu province, a lot in Shanxi province.
As well.
Yeah. In Henan, there's actually a gigantic Hui community. And then, interestingly, in cities like Tianjin, big Hui population, in Hainan, actually, and in Yunnan, there are very large pockets of Hui people who are not really connected with the people in the Northwest, but... nonetheless regard themselves as Hui.
And as just a little footnote, in your ancestral hometown of Kaifeng, Kaiser, the Jews, the famous Jews of Kaifeng, as far as I know, have been registered as Hui.
They had been for a long time. They finally, I think they're pushing to be recognized as a separate religion. Huh? They were called the Hui who picked tendon out of meat, the Qujing Hui Min, or something like that, which meant, they were Jewish people, but they had kind of lost that overt identity, but made themselves sort of appear to be one of the recognized religious minorities, the Hui. They were Blue Hat Hui or something like that, they also call themselves. In any case, let's talk about the level of religiosity among the Hui, which I'm, I guess, given to understand is relatively mild, limited to kind of hygienic practices and dietary practices, you know, not eating pork. What's your sense of how religiosity there is trending, whether there is, you know, an increasing amount of interest in Quranic studies and so forth?
Yes. One of the things that struck me was, like, when I compare a mosque in Xinjiang and a mosque in Ningxia, was I just didn't see a lot of young people in Ningxia. But in Xinjiang, you do see, at prayer time, a majority of people are older people, but you do see a lot of young Uyghurs as well. But and speaking to a few imams in mosques in Ningxia, both this year and when I was there last year, I got the feeling that among young people, it was definitely on the decline. Mm. And I think one of the reasons is I wanted to take a look at how schools function in Ningxia and Xinjiang, because I think that's at the heart of the issue. And I think one of the complaints that you hear both in Xinjiang and Ningxia is that both in primary schools and middle schools, there is no religious teaching. Like, unlike in India and unlike in other Muslim countries, when you start reading the Quran when you're young, the Chinese government has sort of said that you have to be 18 years old before you start reading the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So what imams say is that by the time they're 18, there's no interest. So, and you have to find a job, you got to go to college. And the only way of getting a religious education is if you pick an Islamic college, which does not make much sense, I mean, in terms of finding a job. So essentially, in some ways, they have to choose between pursuing their religious identity and sort of surviving economically.
Surely, Beijing has some rationale for that policy of not exposing people not of majority to theology, right? I presume that the thinking is that if you're not sort of mature enough to make decisions about these things, it shouldn't be visited on you, and you shouldn't be indoctrinated into, it shouldn't be made part and parcel of your learning of the language.
That's true, but then it's also worth mentioning that in theory, at least, that according to China's laws, that both Ningxia and Xinjiang kind of can decide their own education policies because they are autonomous regions. So according to the law, they can set, I mean, it's for them to decide when people can start studying religion. But it doesn't work that way. As you said, I think it's just that the feeling is one sort of dean at one of the Islamic colleges in Yinchuan kind of bluntly told me it's the reason is to the message is that it's your national identity comes before your religious identity. So in school, you sort of learn Chinese history. And he said, you know, at the entrance to the college, there's a huge sign saying, you know, I guo, I jiao, trying to say that,
I jiao, I guo.
No, yeah, and it's obviously intended. So I think that's part of what's going on.
And how much sensitivity have you encountered in reporting on Islam in China? You know, when you go to Ningxia and Xinjiang,
that's a good question.
Do you have problems talking to people?
Like, I think I've been in Xinjiang. It's been fascinating because, like, I think it's really strange, but there's very strong cultural affinity to India and Indians. So wherever I went, like, I was really welcomed, and they always say you look like us. So I thought it would be harder to speak to them. I think it's easier for me in some ways to connect at a very fundamental level and speak to Uyghurs than it is to speak with Chinese. So it was very strange. I didn't expect this at all. And like Indian movies are huge in Xinjiang. So I would have people welcome me to their homes. And the only troubles I had were from the government and the police.
Yeah, but what about that? How closely did they follow you when you're
pretty good. In Urumqi, it's actually all right, where you when you arrive in Urumqi and you check into a hotel, you get the sort of expected visit from the YBAN, and they sort of ask you what you're doing here and stuff like that. But in Kashgar, it's sort of usually you have either they come follow you or they sort of keep tabs on you and know where you are, or they would your interpreter would be switched for some strange reason, and you'd have a guy who's sent from the Public Security Bureau. I mean, like, they're very worried about what's happening in Kashgar. But in Urumqi, it's sort of not, you don't find too many problems.
That's actually encouraging that Urumqi, where there was such rioting, 2 years ago, that it seems to have liberalized a bit, at least in the way, I mean, so it's the visit from the YBAN, and that's about it.
Pretty much.
They don't really have to say too much. That is encouraging. I wanted to ask, one of the really pronounced differences between the Hui of China and their Muslim co-religionists in a lot of Central Asia and South and Southeast Asia and Middle East, North Africa, is the role of women. I don't know if you saw an article from, it was about 5 years old, but Alexa Olson, who was on this show very recently, wrote very extensively on the role of Hui women and how they are able to actually act as ahongs, imams. I think it's probably the only country in the world where that's sort of nodded at.
I did see that, but I don't know, like, to be honest, I don't know how far that actually plays out in a day-to-day thing, because in the colleges that I visited, they had female students as well, and they don't live together. They have separate dorms and everything, which is expected. But some of the female students were training as imams, but what one of those guys, one of the teachers told me was that they had this problem where there were too few sort of opportunities for female imams, and there were too many people sort of training to, like, studying, to become imams. So they kind of hadn't figured out what to do. And what happens is you also get language training. So many of the girls sort of end up moving to places like even Wuxi and working, as translators.
Wuxi.
Yeah, so, I mean, so there's an issue that he said in his sort of very pragmatic, practical world, he said we have an oversupply.
Maybe we should just clarify for people who don't know, making an offhand reference to the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province, why we would do that. Wuxi is, of course, has become a real trade, one hates to use the word Mecca, but a major place for people from all over the Middle East and from North Africa to come and buy crap, right? Plastic, shoddily made Chinese goods and bring them back across.
People from everywhere, really, but there's a very big
but there's a huge
Muslim
Middle Eastern
population.
Yeah. I would recommend that everyone read an article written in the magazine Fast Company by a guy named Dan Levin, who also writes for the New York Times, really good piece about Wuxi just from a couple of months ago.
But I think it's fair to say that on the whole, you do see, I think, the place of women's position in society in Ningxia, you do see a difference from Xinjiang. And yes. I think you do see a lot more people out on the street working, women in Ningxia, Hui women in Ningxia. So I think that maybe, I think probably it's part of a larger sort of trend of social relations in Ningxia, which is quite different from Xinjiang and Central Asia as well.
So would you say that the main focus of policy change that people are looking for has to do with, it's mostly, what, teaching the Quran in earlier stages of education, Arabic education in general?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because there's a fear in Xinjiang that the Chinese government kind of wants to transform Xinjiang to where Ningxia is right now.
I see.
And that's, so there's a feeling that they want all of them to be Chinese speakers and Uyghur to be studied only like as a special sort of strange language that they have to learn. So, and so I think there are two different sort of issues in Xinjiang and Ningxia. In Xinjiang, I think language is also at the heart of the issue, and it's very closely tied to religion, because since I think it was 2001, the government has sort of said they want to universalize bilingual education in primary and middle schools. So usually how it pans out is when you have bilingual education, you study Uyghur language less, you study Uyghur culture less, and it's closing the space for religious schools that used to operate in Xinjiang. Like you used to have Muslim schools in many mosques where you'd have maybe a group of 10, 15 students studying. But I can't confirm this, but I'm told that's now illegal, that you can't get education in a mosque. And even in Kashgar, you do see, posters everywhere saying, you know, stop illegal education and support the party. And so, which is a sign that it is a problem, that they don't want informal Absolutely. Religious study sessions.
So of course, this is an issue that was solved in among the Hui, among the Dungan, 500 years ago. They don't have an indigenous language separate from Chinese, right? And
they don't.
Haven't for several centuries.
And they do. And I think Arabic is only sort of a very niche sort of subject that people study in colleges, and usually because they want to end up working in North Africa. I think the reason
and
the
Farsi
government...
Farsi too, which I was surprised to read.
I think Farsi sort of faded away at the expense of Arabic. But I think part of the reason why the Chinese government's doing it is they're sort of making Ningxia a trade center for Middle East, North Africa, and they are training like thousands of interpreters. So I think that's part of the reason behind why they're investing in Arabic.
Right, the new Silk Road thing.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on and talk. Make some recommendations. I think we have a few things that we want to recommend. Jeremy, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I just wanted to recommend Cai Xin's English Weekly. It's called Cai Xin Weekly. I think it's actually still fortnightly, but I guess it will become weekly. So this is the English digest of reporting done by Cai Xin, which is Hu Shuli's new magazine. She originally of Caijing fame, and it's called Cai Xin Weekly: China Economics and Finance, and it contains some of the more interesting stuff that's coming out of Cai Xin's newsroom.
Is there stuff on there that's not on their site, on their English website?
I think most of it is on their English website, so I'm not particularly wedded to print, but you can get it in print. But, I mean, just as an example how they are, what they're doing, issue 39, September the 5th, The cover story was Running the Lights, Signal Error and Death Aboard China's Bullet Trains. Yeah, obviously in the wake of the Wenzhou disaster, but kind of anticipating what's going on with the Shanghai subway. Ballsy, interesting, long-form reporting done by Chinese journalists in China. It's good stuff.
The editor of this publication, of all their English language stuff, Li Xin, is a guest on this podcast.
He has been a guest on this podcast, and we've cooperated with them, which I suppose we should say as full disclosure. But I just recommend taking a look at Cai Xin if you haven't.
Great endorsement. I hardly agree. Anath, what do you got for us?
I think for Xinjiang, as we discussed earlier, I think James Millward's book. Something that's a very good introduction.
Oh, you just stole my recommendation.
And no, I think I'd also want to give a shout out to the blog, which I think Far West China, which is very interesting and regularly updated and has nice pictures and stuff about travel, which is sort of lighter side stuff.
Oh, it's very good. Far West China.
Right. I don't know if you've seen that.
I don't know who actually writes it, but it's
Josh.
It's quite good.
Josh Sumners, I think I've got his name right. He's contributed something to Dunway about the rawap, which is a Uyghur instrument. But he used to live in Xinjiang. He's, I think, back in the United States now, but continues to follow Xinjiang news.
Great.
There was one more book that I want to recommend. To be honest, I haven't read this yet, but I've heard very good things about it. I think it just came out a few months ago, and it's called The Tree That Bleeds. And it's about, it was written by, I think, someone from England who lived in Xinjiang for a couple of years and lived through cities, maybe Yining and somewhere else where they had arrived. So I think that's, I've heard good things about it, but I can't personally vouch for it because I haven't read it yet.
Well, so, put that on our list and check it out. Let me, I mean, I my thunder was slightly stolen by not there. I wanted to recommend the book Eurasian Crossroads by James Millward. He's a professor at Georgetown who was actually my professor when I was a graduate student at Arizona. And part of the reason that I left that program is because he went on to bigger and better things than Arizona. He's also a very dear friend of mine, I should say. But Eurasian Crossroads, it's a history of Xinjiang. Very, very readable. It's a terrific book. I highly recommend.
No, and the book that I was talking about, I just found the name of the author. His name is Nick Holstock, and it's called The Tree That Bleeds.
So The Tree That Bleeds, yeah. Nick Holstock. I'll check it out. Also check out Beyond the Pass, another book by James Millward, which is about commerce and ethnicity in Qing Central Asia. It focuses on commercial relationships between and among different ethnic groups, including the Uyghurs, the Han Chinese, and the Hui in the western parts of China of during the Qing Empire. Well, great. That's all we've got time for today, but I want to give a huge shout out. Thanks so much, Anand, for coming on today.
It's always fun to be here, so happy to.
Yeah. So, and Jeremy, thanks as always for being here. We're going to take a break next week for the Chinese national holiday, and Jeremy, alas, will be out of town for a couple of weeks, so I'll have to run the show solo. But we look forward to seeing you next time on the Seneca Podcast. Thanks.